You're listening to the Fertility Docs Uncensored podcast, featuring insight on all things fertility from some of the top-rated doctors around America. Whether you're struggling to conceive or just planning for your future family, we're here to guide you every step of the way.
Hi, everyone. We're back with another episode of Fertility Docs Uncensored. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Abby Eblen from Nashville Fertility Center, and I am joined by my fabulous, fantastic friends, Dr. Susan Hudson from Texas Fertility Center.
Hello.
And Dr. Carrie Bedient from the Fertility Center of Las Vegas.
Hey.
So what's up, guys? What's been going on?
I just finished a guilty pleasure book on Audible.
Oh, yeah? Do we guess? Is it... Okay, when I think guilty pleasure, I think like People Magazine style topics.
Yeah, I'm a People Magazine subscriber,
it's along that line.
Okay.
And so, what is it?
It was Spare.
Oh, man, Spare. I've read that. I've listened to that book. It is a great book. It's really eye-opening.
I've always been enamored by the royal family, okay? Yep. And I mean, I was 4 years old when my mama woke me up at like 2 a.m. to watch Diana and Charles get married.
Me too. I saw that too. Carrie's too young for that, I think, right?
You don't remember. Yeah, she's too young for that. But had a wedding party at my house when Kate and Will got married. And
I was on my honeymoon when they got married. And I woke up god awful early to watch that wedding.
Yes. and so I wanted to listen to it, but I was like conflicted because I was like, oh, should I, you know, it was a big decision. It was a bigger decision.
Not for me.
And then I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. And I didn't even realize that Prince Harry was the speaker. Of the book, the narrator,
which made it so cool. Actually,
oh my goodness, it was so much more powerful.
Yes,
and I have to say, like I truly enjoyed the book, and I know it's one of those things that it's like there's always three sides to every story.
Yes,
and if you go into it like understanding that. But I think it was very well done.
Yes.
I have a lot more respect for him than I did previously in the things that there were lots of things that like I just never knew about him that I was just like,
were some things I was shocked that he divulged. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he's saying this.
Yeah. But I mean, it was truly like an insight into his heart. And I enjoyed it. I would highly recommend it.
And it's surprising how the royal family all kind of like vie for their spot in the sun. And they do that by, it seems, based on what he said, by putting other people down in the family. You know, it's like instead of supporting your family and building them up, you put other people down and that way you look better, you know? So it's kind of sad, really.
I have to say I expected the whole book to be about that, but a lot of it isn't.
It's a lot of good, interesting stories.
A lot of it is purely just his story.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, obviously he has a huge, huge issue with the press and how they have reflected his entire existence. And I completely get it. But I enjoyed it. I would recommend it.
So Carrie, what have you been reading lately?
So I really like, there's an author by the name of Leigh Bardugo, and I loved Harry Potter. And so when I was looking for what are other, you know, similar type series of stories, her name came up, and she's got three kind of mini series that are all tied together about a fantasy building world about, you know, Grisha, who are people who have, you know, various powers, like not quite so much as the magical world, but in that realm.
And I'm very interested about this. I like this type of stuff.
I'm not big into sci-fi. For whatever reason, I just can't seem to get into that.
It's somewhere between sci-fi and fantasy, and it's very well done. She wrote another one called Ninth House, which is the Grishaverse is geared towards like, I don't know, young adult type stuff. There's nothing super serious in there. Ninth House is an adult book. And it was just, so well written. And she just had another one come out. And so I'm on the library wait list to get her next one, which is a sequel to Ninth House. But I have literally stayed up all night reading those books because it's the only time when I have enough hours free to just crank through it. And yeah. So that's my current favorite.
Very cool. Well, my all-time favorite author ever is Malcolm Gladwell. I love his books. They're so interesting. I love, love, love his books. Nonfiction, I've really gotten in lately to Taylor Jenkins Reid. She does historical fiction, and I've realized I kind of like that.
Historical fiction.
I do too.
And you know, you think of historical fiction, I used to think that it was like men, it was in the Elizabethan period or, you know, a long time ago. But her books are set in a lot of them are set in the 1960s. And so the one that probably you've heard of recently that I was listening to on Audible when it came out on Netflix is Daisy Jones and the Six, which is really good. It's about a rock band in the 60s. The other one that I read recently is Carrie Soto is Back. It's about a tennis star. And I'm not big into tennis at all, but it's just, she is such a good author. She just makes you feel like you're right in the middle of kind of that time period. And it's just, her books are very different. One was like The Seven Husbands of Evelyn. I forgot what the name of that one was, but it just totally different time period, totally different writing. And she's a great author. She's so good at putting you right in the middle of that era and right in the middle of the book.
Neat.
That's fabulous.
So,
what's the question?
What's up with our questions? Yes.
Our question of the day. I am 35 and have unexplained secondary infertility. Started trying for baby number two a few years ago, got pregnant, but had a miscarriage at 7 weeks, continued trying on their own, and the following year was referred to fertility clinic where they got pregnant during the first IUI, which also ended in a miscarriage, no heartbeat at 8 weeks. Did 3 more IUIs, all negative. Moved on to IVF this year. 11 eggs, 5 blasts frozen. PGT tested. 3 normal, 1 abnormal, 1 unknown. Just found out that our first medicated FET failed was on esterase PIO endometrin. Was wondering if the docs have any ideas why I can't get stay pregnant, embryo or uterus issue. Any testing I should push for before trying for another FET, and if it's worth adjusting the protocol into what? Thank you. That's a great question.
That is a great question. There's a lot of layers to that question.
Not a great answer, though. I mean, the basic question, I think, is she has 3 normal blasts, transferred 1 and didn't get pregnant. What can I do to improve my chances? Would you change the protocol?
Yeah.
So what would you guys do?
I would say, first of all, make sure you've had a recurrent pregnancy loss evaluation, making sure you don't have antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, normal TSH, normal prolactin. We obviously have chromosomally normal embryos. I would probably recommend a hysteroscopy at this time to look directly in the uterus. Pretty good data to say that even with a normal saline ultrasound after a chromosomally normal embryos transferred, there's a reasonable chance there might be something else that might be interfering with good, healthy implantation. So those are kind of my top things that I would do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you could think about a different protocol, but, you know, as Carrie has said before, you know, this is one of the few areas where if you continue to do the same thing, you very likely will get different results. There's so many things we don't know about the uterus. We don't know about implantation. Very little has changed about that in the last really 20 years, unfortunately. There's a couple of tests out there, which we have talked about on several occasions, the ERA biopsy and the Receptiva biopsy. Those are things I think you should at least talk to your doctor about. It's worth maybe looking at one of those since you've had one failed FET. Most of us don't use those as initial test before you ever have an FET. Certainly, if you have one remaining blastocyst, I usually talk to all of my patients about that just because I want them to be able to weigh in on the decision and decide if they want to do those things as well. Some people would think about going to a natural cycle FET, and that means different things to different people in terms of how natural it is and how much is replaced. Some centers have pretty similar success rates. Some have a little bit lower success rates with the natural FET. So I think that's something to talk to your doctor about as well. But unfortunately, there's just a lot of things we don't know about implantation and why a beautiful embryo and an easy transfer didn't result in a pregnancy.
I would agree with all of that. You know, hysteroscopy, RPL panel, and Receptiva probably be things that I would consider. You know, different protocol, you know, maybe not. But I would agree with what you guys are saying.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, today we're going to talk about a topic near and dear to many people's hearts. And that is, do I have PCOS? And that is an onion with lots of layers as well. And so kind of starting on that, Carrie, can you, for our listeners that don't know what PCOS is, can you tell us a little bit about what it is and we'll go from there?
So PCOS stands for polycystic ovarian syndrome, which is a stupid name for it. I will go
on record. Why is it a stupid name?
It is a stupid name.
Because people think, oh my God, I have cysts, I've got cancer, and I'm going to die. And none of that is true because it's not really cyst. It should be named, and
let's come up with a name that we think it should be named.
Polyfollicular ovarian syndrome.
Yes.
Because that's what it is.
Yeah. So the cyst that they're talking about is when you do an ultrasound on somebody with PCOS, they have a ton of follicles, which are those little early egg phases that are starting to grow. And so it's a tiny little black circle because
baby eggs is what I refer to them as. They're little baby eggs.
I say that they're the houses of the eggs.
Oh, I like, yeah, okay,
but fine. The eggs are babies too, though. The follicles are babies.
Follicle houses the egg.
So it's the sac around the egg. Yeah, so okay.
It's the house of the egg.
Okay, so baby houses. And you see a ton of them, and they're little black circles because an ultrasound fluid shows up as black. And you see a crap ton of them. And typically a cyst is designated as a fluid-filled sac. So while technically this is kind of true, usually cysts are bigger. They're like
greater than 2 centimeters that aren't supposed to be there at a specific point in time.
And they're bad. These are good little cysts, good little baby cysts.
And so what it should be is polyfollicular, because you look in there and you see a ton of these little follicles. None of them are big. They're all usually between 2 and 10 millimeters. Millimeters, not centimeters. And they're just filling that whole space. So that's how it got its name, which is a stupid name, wrong. And I petition we change it to whomever in the universe named PCOS.
Well, you know, the history behind that, the reason why, at least what I've read, the reason why it was named polycystic ovarian syndrome is because back a long time ago when OBGYNs did laparoscopy, and by the way, we were the first physicians that started doing laparoscopy way before the general surgeons. So our doctors, our forefathers would do laparoscopy and they would see these ovaries that looked like they had cysts. They were kind of bulging and looked cystic. So they didn't have ultrasounds really to rely on back then. So they called them polycystic ovaries.
But we've changed the names of so many other things. I think it's time we change this.
Well, actually it used to be Stein-Leventhal syndrome. So they did change that name. So we should change the name. I agree. I think we should petition with ASRM to change the name. It's a misnomer.
So in addition to the follicles and the poly, quote unquote, cysts, which is still dumb, go on record, blah, blah, blah. There's also a component of cycle dysregulation. So very commonly, these women have irregular cycles. That can be anything from a 35-day cycle to never, ever getting a cycle unless you take medication to bring it on. Mm-hmm. And then there's also a male hormonal component or hyperandrogenism, where we see some expression of higher male hormones that can either be in blood tests or it can be in symptoms. Because if you see someone who has a full beard or a partial beard or lots of hair on their chest or their back or their abdomen or any number of places, lots of acne, all of those types of things, male pattern baldness, things that indicate a higher presence of male hormones that are active. And like I said, it doesn't necessarily have to be something that's picked up in blood, because you can have a very small difference in a measurable amount of that hormone that has a huge clinical difference. Like the difference of 1% can be the difference in a woman of looking absolutely hairless to looking very male.
I'm going to hijack this for just a second. So people sometimes get we uncover are a lot more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Carrie.
So I was going to say, one of the things that I worry about most when someone comes in and says, I have PCOS because I have irregular cycles, a lot of the other stuff you treat pretty similarly. Like if someone has PCOS versus a non-classical congenital adrenal hyperplasia, something along those lines, like effectively you're going to treat them the same way. One of the biggest things that you treat differently is when someone has irregular cycles, not from PCOS, but from declining ovarian function.
Yeah.
So when we go and we say, okay, let's trust but verify, then typically what we're trying to do is say, okay, do you have decreased ovarian reserve for some reason? Because we are going to be much more aggressive and we are going to approach it very differently than someone with PCOS, where you know, they may do ovulatory induction agents like letrozole, or, you know, much more milder approaches with someone with decreased ovarian reserve, we're going to approach it mentally very differently in order to get you the results. So nailing down that diagnosis is kind of important.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the biggest differences that you sort of alluded to is it's not just we'll treat them differently, but the prognosis is different too. I mean, for people that are young, PCOS patients, really high AMH, which by the way, is not a bad thing. We can't put eggs back in you if you don't have them. And really, I have a lot of patients that just emotionally come in and are really distraught and really upset and like, oh my gosh, I've read all this and no one's ever said this, but I really think I have this. And they're really distraught and really anxious and really terrified. And I would echo what Susan said. I love when we make the diagnosis, because really with PCOS, the way that I sort of tell patients is that in a nutshell, your brain is just not talking to your ovary. It's not telling your ovary to grow your eggs. It's kind of like if you plant a seed in the soil, you have all these little seeds, but you just don't have the water and the sunshine or the hormones from the brain to make those seeds grow. And we can give you those seeds pretty easily with Clomid. Something like 80% of people ovulate with Clomid and probably similar amount with letrozole. And a lot of times there's actually been a study that's shown that PCOS patients tend to do better with letrozole. Mm-hmm. So we start that medicine. And if we get the right dose, you know, if you're ovulating, once you start to make an egg every month, and you know, the good chance you will, within 3 or 4 cycles, something like 50 to 60% of people will probably be pregnant. So it's a really successful treatment, you know, once we make that diagnosis. So to that end, Susan, so say we've made the diagnosis now, we have the lab work back, we've all come to the conclusion that yes, it's PCOS. What's the next step?
Well, I think an important part is that we want to make sure it's only PCOS, because we don't want to be making you ovulate and, you know, letting you go off and do your thing if we don't know if tubes and sperm are working the way we expect. Okay.
Yeah, we don't want to ignore the other obvious things, right?
Yes. Because I mean, we'll also have people who come in, they're like, oh, I have PCOS, I know I have PCOS. And it's like, okay, everything checks out. We need to do, the patients are like, we need to do this. And I'm like, oh, let's hold off. Okay, because we don't want you doing treatments that we know aren't going to have a chance of success if your tubes are blocked or if we have really poor sperm counts or things like that. So making sure you actually have a complete fertility evaluation, including those components, I think is very, very important.
So what would you specifically do then if somebody goes into their doctor? What would you recommend for a PCOS patient?
So in addition to I would at least recommend an AMH level. Okay, make sure your ovaries are got high AMH, because if you have your regular periods and you have low AMH, that's a whole different ballgame. Okay.
So AMH is ovarian reserve. It's looking to make sure you really have a lot of eggs in your ovaries, which is what we think if you have PCOS.
Right. At least making sure you get your thyroid, your TSH, and your prolactin level drawn, and then making sure you have an HSG, the diatessic of fallopian tubes, and a basic semen analysis. Those are the absolutes. There's other things I typically do, but those are kind of the big ones.
And really for everybody, no matter what your diagnosis is, no matter what your doctor diagnoses you with, those are the basic things that you want to have no matter what, because you don't want to go down some path, like Susan said, and do some sort of treatment for 6 or 8 months, particularly if you're late 30s, early 40s, and find out, lo and behold, you know, my tubes are blocked. Mm-hmm. That didn't help anybody.
Two conditions can coexist at the same time. Mm-hmm. So that's why even when people come in knowing full well what's going on, we always check the other stuff, because it only takes once in your career to get burned by thinking, oh, I know exactly what's going on, and you miss something, and then you feel like a complete and utter moron.
Yeah,
because
absolutely.
You missed the obvious.
Yeah,
yeah,
you have to
I
keep
remember
your mind
in
open.
Med school, there's some sort of Latin phrase that essentially says, if you can track everything down to one source, that's probably what it is. And I'm like, that is true in everything except for fertility medicine.
Yeah, and medicine in general, actually. You need to keep an open mind. I think as you get older and have more experience, you realize anything can happen, and you need to keep an open mind for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Carrie, once you've had the diagnosis, you've now had testing, everything else seems to be fine. What's the next step?
So there's usually some discussion, because everyone's like, well, how can I, you know, what can I do to make this better? And so a lot of the times we'll have discussion about lifestyle, because there's the standard stuff we tell all of our fertility disability people of no smoking, you know, really minimal, if any, drinking, no drug use, kind of all of those things. But lifestyle and exercise and nutrition start to kick in even more for PCOS because so many people are struggling with extra weight. And I cannot tell you the number of times someone comes in, they say, I am doing absolutely everything and I just can't drop the weight. And so there's some people where it's, you have a very obvious first step because when you ask them about nutrition, you ask them about exercise, it's, you know, I drink 3 sodas a day. I only eat one meal because I'm otherwise busy. And then I overeat and I don't exercise whatsoever. Those patients are the easy ones to start working with because one of my favorite questions is, okay, what's one thing that you know you need to do with nutrition? What's one thing you know you need to do with exercise? And then we start building, you know, tiny baby step plans and they do that. What is more challenging are the people who are really working actively on everything and they are eating well, they are exercising. And for those people, I will oftentimes try and pull in other professionals, a nutritionist, a trainer, you know, people like that who can really help forward on that component of their care, because that is always the first question of, well, what can I do? I want to cure this on my own. And for better or worse, it's really not a cure. It's just optimizing symptoms.
So why are you focused on weight, Carrie? Why is that important, particularly for PCOS patients?
So for PCOS patients, there is a baseline difficulty in ovulating. When you add the weight into that, in some respects, extra weight acts like built-in birth control because fat cells produce a mild form of estrogen. It's a weaker form, but if you get enough of it, it kind of functions like birth control. And so it impairs the signaling that goes between your brain and your ovaries that says release the egg. And so if you can lose some of those fat cells, you will drop those hormone levels, which are not easily measured, and you get you are more susceptible to being positively impacted by the medication, and you're more likely to go back to ovulating on your own. Because there are a lot of patients when they figure out how to lose the weight, which is not easy, especially in PCOS.
And even just 5 or 10%.
Even just 5 or 10%, like a relatively low amount, they go back to ovulating on their own. And for PCOS, that is the holy grail. Because if you can ovulate on your own, then you don't necessarily need me. And while I love to be needed, it's even better for patients when they don't need me.
So Susan, what are some other associated things that patients can work on that may help with their PCOS?
Mm-hmm. So in addition to that, I would say kind of watching your diet. Okay. I tend to recommend more of a Mediterranean style diet, lots of green leafy vegetables, healthy fats, proteins, those types of things, minimizing your carb intake. Those things are real. You know, there's some pretty decent information that essentially says that people with PCOS, their mitochondria, the little powerhouses within their cells, don't work the same as they do in other people. Okay. And because of that, when they're working on things like weight loss and lifestyle modifications, they get frustrated because they are having to work harder than other people. You know, they'll go to the gym with their husband or spouse or their girlfriend or whoever. Mm-hmm. And they're like, they're doing the same thing as I am, but I'm still struggling. Mm-hmm. And what I want to say is the struggle is real. It is not impossible to surmount, okay? But with those types of things, you know, when you maximize your diet and your exercise and your kind of healthy living habits, you're going to improve how insulin and blood sugars are regulated within your body, which actually have a huge impact on your ovarian function. Also, you know, taking time to focus on yourself and really kind of treating yourself as a good person is really important. Okay. And people tend to have a lot of depression, associated with PCOS. And so if you're needing help because you're struggling so much, not only with kind of the fertility aspect, but as well as some of the other lifestyle things that are challenges, ask for help. You know, your reproductive endocrinologist, your OB-GYN, you know, we're happy to point you in the right directions to either, you know, whether you need counseling or sometimes you may need medicine to help you through those things. It's okay. People are always worried about, oh no, I don't want to be on anything thing going into pregnancy. And an important thing to know is that mental health is so important during pregnancy.
Sure.
That yes, there are some medications we would like to avoid, but pregnancy outcomes, if you're medicated and healthy mentally, actually are improved than if you wouldn't have been on the medicines if you needed them. So those are some important kind of caveats of kind of the surrounding things.
So Carrie, Susan touched upon insulin. She mentioned insulin as being important. Why is that something that we like to check? And why is that something that we may even treat in PCOS patients?
So we found that people who have insulin insensitivity, where they have insulin present, but their body just doesn't respond to it as well and doesn't listen to it as easily and requires more of it just to get the same thing done. It's kind of the equivalent of when we talk about FSH going up and your ovaries being insensitive to it. You know, the analogy that I like is your mom tells you to clean your room. The first time she tells you, it's in a nice inside voice. The 85th time she tells you, is she screaming? It's the same kind of thing. Like when you have insulin resistance, your body is screaming, get it together and process the sugar in a way that will allow you to use it. And when you're not doing that, ovulation is a lot more difficult. So there are people where when we get their A1Cs down, when we get their body to be a little bit more sensitive to insulin, both through medications and nutrition and exercise, because again, that 5 to 10% weight loss can do wonders on getting the insulin sensitivity back. All of those things can help because again, the goal is ovulation. So if we can get you to ovulate and be more sensitive to the things that will make you ovulate, even if you're not totally doing it on your own, if we can help that along so that all of the other stuff works better, then that's the goal so that we can.
So what you're saying is insulin itself can be problematic. So if you can do things to keep your insulin down, like lower carbohydrate diets or exercise to burn off some of that glucose that keeps your insulin down. If you can't do it with lifestyle, what are some other ways that we can get the insulin down to help a woman ovulate?
So metformin is probably the most common one. And this is a very, very easy, you know, readily available medication. I tend to prefer the extended release forms because the side effects of this one can be unpleasant. Usually with what we consider to be GI upset, whether that's nausea, diarrhea, flatulence, super exciting, very sexy med to be on.
Sounds like one of those commercials you hear on TV. You don't want to hear all those multiple side effects.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, remember the commercial on, I think it was Alestra, where it said the side effect was anal leakage?
It's
like, that's the one when
that's
people
not
talk
metformin
about
though. That's not metformin.
That is not metformin. Metformin, you'll fart and you may have diarrhea, but you're not going to have anal leakage, at least not as one of the main side effects.
So dieting doesn't sound so bad when you talk about those side effects. May accomplish the same thing without the medicine.
I always tell people to take it in the evening, go for the extended release forms because you're taking it just once a day.
Yeah.
Eat it, or take it after you have eaten a full meal to minimize some of these side effects. But that's probably the main medication that people go on. There are a few other of the diabetic medications and also the weight loss medications that people go on. But the metformin is probably the mainstay.
Can I want to go off on another tangent. I'm on tangents today, so you'll just have to deal with
that. Just adding interesting comments in. They're not tangents.
Right. So another thing that has really hit kind of the world recently are medications like Ozempic and Mounjaro.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so it is very important for our listeners to understand these are not medications that are pregnancy friendly. And
that's right.
Fact,
yeah.
You need to be off these medications for at least 2 months before trying to conceive. So I don't know. I can't even tell you how many people are coming into my office and they're like, we've been trying to get pregnant and I'm on Ozempic. And I'm like, that's great. So you need to talk to your prescribing doctor about potentially getting off Ozempic and then you can do your evaluation, but we need to wait 2 months. And that is for your safety. It is for the safety of your baby. Okay. And even when we're doing the evaluation, if you might need to have surgery or something like that, anesthesiologists are not excited about you having any theoretically elective surgery while you're taking these medications because they delay what we call gastric emptying, which is essentially emptying the stuff in your stomach into the rest of your intestine. So there's a much higher risk of aspiration.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that one. Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, when these first came out, I know some of us were doing egg retrievals on them and that mm-hmm. type of thing. But in the anesthesia world, they're essentially saying hard stop to elective procedures while you're taking these. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they seem to be the panacea at this moment, but they're not completely benign.
And do you know about that? I don't know about the other drugs. There's a couple of other drugs around like that too. Is it just Ozempic? Do you know?
Mounjaro too.
Mounjaro. Yeah, okay.
The whole family.
Okay.
I can't think of any weight loss medications that are safe in pregnancy.
Uh-huh. That's true. That's a good point.
The whole class of medications. And
but the difference with this is though, you have to be off of it for 8 weeks. So unlike the other ones, I think, you know, we just tell them to stop those. But yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. So any other comments we want to make about the diagnosis of PCOS?
You are not alone.
There is very treatable.
You are not alone.
Yeah. Very treatable for sure.
Right. And you know, when you're going through fertility, I like to always say, I explain to my PCOS patients that PCOS is how you're wired. It is okay. It's kind of like, I have red hair. I can dye my hair. I can do all kinds of things to it. It is part of who I am. PCOS is part of who you are. When you're trying to get pregnant, we're going to help you go in one direction. When you're not trying to go get pregnant, it's important to talk to somebody like us or your gynecologist about how to mm-hmm. keep yourself healthy. But it is part of who you are, and that is okay. Okay. But understanding that it is part of your being and that you need to help manage it in different ways is important in your life as a whole.
Well said.
One thing I would say too is after you have that baby, you're probably not going to fix it. People always have this hope that at one day it will go away. Probably not, unless you have the type of PCOS that's responsive to weight loss and you've lost a bunch of weight. But otherwise, like Susan said, it's just part of who you are and it's the way you're wired and it's okay. We can fix it. We can work with it.
It'll go away when you go into menopause.
Yeah.
True. Well, very good. So to our audience, thanks for listening and tune in next week for more. Also, be sure to subscribe and leave a review in Apple Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. We're also on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We're on YouTube. Be sure to follow and subscribe and to stay updated on all things infertility.
You can also visit fertilitydocsuncensored.com to submit specific questions you have about infertility. All questions will be answered anonymously on the podcast in our Ask the Doc segment, so don't hold back. We love episode ideas, so let us know what you're thinking and what you want to hear.
As always, this podcast is intended for entertainment and is not a substitute for medical advice from your own physician. All right, we'll see you soon. Bye.